views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon and this decay and do the other thing.
One small
step for man.
We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents. Consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to our Sunday Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thanks for tuning in today. We appreciate your being here. A couple of real quick announcements. You can call us and you can talk with our guest today, Dylan Taylor. Our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Do remember that we're not using call screeners, so be patient and let the phone ring if it's ringing. And we'll answer it and bring you up on air as quickly as possible. Do note that if applicable, we'll hold you over the break. And if the line is clear, we do answer the phone during the break and put you on hold for the show. So don't let break stop you from giving us a quick call. You can also send us email at drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. You can also post a comment or ask a question through our Space Show blog. And to do that is to go to the website, thespaceshow.com, go all the way over to the far right to upcoming show menus, and then this is the first show listed. That is our archive page for this show, so open it up, and comments and questions are down at the bottom, and as soon as you post your comment, I'll get a copy of it and can bring it up on the program. But the telephone is the preferred way. We much prefer phone calls over email or blog comments. 1-866-687-7223. And regarding our website, we do have a very detailed website newsletter that is already up for the coming week. So you can see all the programs we have planned in detail. There is a Hotel Mars program already identified, and it will show up later this afternoon in the upcoming show menu. So you'll see what we're doing on Hotel Mars. It's about a new Lockheed plan. And we have a great guy from Lockheed coming on board to talk about it. But you'll see that on upcoming shows in a little while. The other thing I want to point out are two other changes. Franklin Chang-Diaz of Vazimir is on with Eric Seedhouse tomorrow. But they have congressional visits, I guess, visiting Vazimir for whatever reason. So we're starting the show a little bit late. That's why there's a 2:15 p.m. start time, Pacific time, for that. So we're going to be starting 15 minutes late. So do pay attention to that. And then Friday, we're trying something new. We moved our morning show on Friday to an evening show on Friday, which we've never done before on the Space Show. It will start at 7 p.m., and it's going to be a special open lines program. So we're going to find out if a Friday evening show is a good time for Space Show listeners. So other than that, it's business as usual. I do point out the Sunday show with Sharon Weinberger. She is a fabulous author and has just an incredible new book out about DARPA. Check it out on the newsletters and on the upcoming show menu. And go check her book out on Amazon. And you'll really want to talk to Sharon on Sunday. She has been a guest before. And you'll enjoy hearing from her. So those are a couple of the announcements. Do remember that you are welcome to download our shows and share them with people. There are just a couple of rules about that. So one is don't do anything commercial with the programs and don't edit them. Put edits up on YouTube or anything like that. And written transcripts are not permitted, and even if they're for your own use. So do read our full copyright statement at the bottom of our website pages for thespaceshow.com, as well as onegiantleapfoundation.org, which is our parent and our nonprofit. If you have any questions and or you really have a compelling need to do something with a specific Space Show program or a portion of it, please email me and let me know what it is you want to do and the details, and let's see if we can work something out. Everything we do is archived. You can listen right off of our website or rapidly download the program. There is a store, and you can find that in the upper left menu under support. So if you want t-shirts or something of that nature, coffee mugs, hats, that is where you will find it, under the support menu in the upper left. There is also a listen live button in the menu in the upper left, and that tells you how to listen to a live space show program, an archive program, and we are in the process of adding podcast instructions. And for those of you who are using Alexa or a similar format, we are now podcasting with TuneIn. And we will soon have the TuneIn embedded player on our website at that point. So if you have any questions about any of that, don't hesitate to get a hold of me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then the other really important part of our show is that we are a 501c3 nonprofit. And your contributions and your support keep us on the air. And we're deeply appreciative of that support. Remember, if you're paying federal U.S. taxes, you get a tax deduction for your gift. And the same is true if you're lucky enough to be paying California's taxes, as we are a public benefit corporation over here, and you are entitled to a tax deduction as well off of your California return. If you have any questions about this, do check with your own tax advisor. And I'll be happy to answer any questions as best as I can. If you want to reach me, again, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Then remember, we also have corporate sponsors. You can see their banner ads going across the website. Do check out what's underneath those banner ads from time to time. And I read a short message from our corporate sponsors for each show in the first segment today. We're being sponsored by the New Worlds Conference. And this year, it's in Austin, Texas, as always, November 10th through the 11th. And it's a great event. And I believe there will soon be a discount code for Space Show listeners. So stay tuned on that. And if you're interested in going to the New Worlds Conference in Austin, you'd want to make use of the discount code. So you can check it out at newworlds2017.space. And then the Integrated Space Plan brings you the first segment of our show. Remember, this is a 100-year forecast of our future in space. Their plan includes Earth to orbit and reusable in-space transportation. It also depicts development of the Moon and Mars, followed by a base in the asteroid belt and space settlements. Their website, where you can see all of this, is thespaceplan.com. If you check out the online version, it's got elements in it that expand for more information. But you can buy a full copy, a full-size copy of the space plan for your own use, and that is not obviously interactive. But you can frame it, put it on your door or your wall. It's very inspiring. All of this is available at thespaceplan.com. Don't forget, they just revised it at ISDC 2017. And there is a kids' space plan, a new space plan. So check that out, too, if you have young children and you want to get them going into this area as soon as possible. Finally, for the first segment, the Space Foundation brings you our show. Their 34th symposium is just around the corner, April 16th through the 19th. Again, the Broadmoor Hotel, Colorado Springs, Colorado. Check it all out at spacesymposium.org. And for those of you in the Bay Area, they have a financial economic investment two-day program the end of August. It is in San Francisco at one of the Hyatt hotels. I will be there. It's just a drive across the bridge for me. And if you're going to be there and you'd like to meet face-to-face, do get a hold of me. I'll give you my cell phone number so we can text one another and find one another. But that is at the end of this month, and you can get all that information off of their website, which is spacefoundation.org. And I'm very happy to bring back to the show today Dylan Taylor, and he is a real commercial space guy, for real, an investment guru type, and knows these subjects for real. He has several investments within SmallSat and Earth observation sector, including OmniEarth, Cape Analytics, Planet, RBC Signals, Artisat, York Space System, Leo Labs, and more. He is a leading angel investor. He is a speaker at the New Space Conference in San Francisco in June. And we're very fortunate to have Dylan back with us today. How are you, Dylan?
terrific, David. Thank you so much. Great to be here.
I'm being brought to Rutgers University in the engineering department through my good friend Dr. Ben Arroyo, November 8th, which means, unfortunately, I will not be at the New Worlds Conference. But they want me to talk about commercial space and policy, and I was thinking, and this is a question I told you I was going to ask you, if I'm going to talk about commercial space, well, first of all, I believe commercial space means you actually have commercial customers, not just the government as a customer. And number two, you got to be making a profit, or at least you're on the fast track to making a profit, because commercial to me is that you're profit-oriented and making a profit. And I do know how to define profit, although I understand a lot of people in high school and college don't know how to define that these days. So I'm asking you, what are the subsectors in the overall commercial space sector that truly are commercial? Where are the trends? Who's making the money? Where are the ROIs? Where are the best prospects? If you're a young entrepreneur and you want to start up a new space commercial business, what do you want to look at? Where are your opportunities? How do you see all of that emerging? I don't know if you were at the SmallSat conference that just ended, but that certainly has a focus on small satellites and CubeSats and that part of the market. But where do you see the action?
Sure. Well, first of all, space, in my view, has never been more commercial or more interesting to investors. Since I was last on the show, David, I think it was December. In this past 8 months, the investment activity within the industry has accelerated dramatically. And we're now getting investors interested in space that are not, in my mind, leading edge investors. They're more mainstream investors. And I think one example of that would be, for example, Sequoia, which is probably the best known VC firm in all of the Valley, recently investing in Vector. And they were, by the way, met on that Series A by Lightspeed Venture Partners and Shasta, also known as being very smart money within the Valley. So the sector itself has become much more mainstream, much more interesting to mainstream investors. And my thesis is they're now recognizing that the economics of the industry are valid, and a lot of what's been discussed in the past that people have been sort of waiting to materialize has become, you know, nearer and presenter in a way that they're now, seeing near-term returns being practical. But to answer your question directly, what sectors within sort of the overall landscape of commercial space are showing the most interest? And I would say it's really two categories, but I would define it, you know, maybe in two different ways. The first category would be launch, of course. We still have an issue with getting mass to space, getting assets to space, and it's not so much cost, which people, I think, focus very much on the disruption of lower cost, reusability, things of that nature when it comes to launch. But it's actually less than that. It's or I should say more than that. It really has to do with maximizing a three-variable equation, which is the cost of launch, which is affordability, the safety or reliability of a launch, and then the third, which I think people really underestimate as being important in the equation, that is availability. And so when you think about microsatellites and you think about launching hardware that might be $100,000 a unit instead of $25 million a unit, it's less important for me to get 99.999% reliability for that launch, and it might even be less important for me to save 10 or 20 or 30% on the launch. What is more important is that I get those assets up there and I get them up there quickly, because hardware sitting on the ground is not generating data, and if it's not generating data, it's not generating revenue. So I think launch is more difficult than people understand, but not for the reasons that they suppose. It really doesn't have to do with the Six Sigma reliability. It has more to do with optimizing this notion of affordability, availability, and reliability. And in that vein, there are only a handful of people who can demonstrate that they are able to do that. And so people like Vector and others who have a track record, at least in terms of their team, are attracting capital. You've seen, I'm sure, that companies like Rocket Labs continue to raise money pretty readily and at very high valuations. So launch would be one category that's very interesting. Not all of the launch players are going to be winners. We know that. But I think a lot of the VCs are entering that space or making bets that they think are reasonably sound. And I think they also believe, as I do, that it's going to not necessarily be an oversupply of launch. And that was one of the theses that VCs had about launch at one time. It's not going to be an oversupply, and it's not going to be an oversupply because it's much more difficult than people realize, just given this three-variable equation I mentioned. Second, which is probably even hotter than launch, is the Earth observation sector. And that I would divide into two categories. One would be the hardware, which, of course, are the spacecraft, the constellations going up, many of which are incredibly interesting, and we should spend some time talking about. But the second is really the software piece. So in that vein, generating data that might be hyperspectral, it might be persistent, meaning always on, but then being able to create products and services based upon that data. And that's where a lot of the innovation on the terrestrial side, machine learning, deep neural networks, algorithms that can actually mine data for predictive analytics, that's where a lot of that is coming into play. One of the bottlenecks, in addition to launch, with getting spacecraft up and the data down is downlink, which is still an issue. And so we've seen a lot of activity in what I would call data services. So this would be companies like Atlas, RBC Signals, that are trying to optimize or, Uberize, if I can use that verb, Uberize bandwidth on the downlink and making sure that data is not only getting down to Earth quickly, but it's getting down to Earth efficiently. And you have other startups like, for example, Analytical Space that's actually looking at laser-based downlink communication, which I think not only has applicability for LEO to terrestrial communication, but could have some deep space point-to-point applications as well. So really software, it's all about the data in terms of the economics. And so software is really driving a lot of it. We had a couple of deals done in the last handful of months that I'm sure you're aware of, but I'll just mention for some of the listeners who might not be. OmniEarth, for example, one of the companies I had invested in that you mentioned, was acquired by EagleView. EagleView itself had been acquired by a private equity firm, Vesta Equity Partners. And essentially, if you look at the strategy there, it's and I'm not saying anything that's non-public. I'm just quoting their press releases. They're essentially taking large sources of data. EagleView was actually doing things like roof measurements and other products and services using optical imagery. And they're taking some of the machine learning expertise that OmniEarth had, crunching data and creating products and services for people like the state of California, and they're actually creating a platform where not only are they going to have more data and more insight into that data, but they can actually achieve scale by selling more and more products and services to more and more clients, be they states, be they private customers, insurance companies, and the like. So my thesis for quite some time has always been that the data piece is going to dwarf the hardware piece, both from a value creation standpoint, but also is going to drive a lot of the investment theses. And that's really come to pass and is becoming dramatically apparent over this last few months.
Is the data piece a real space industry business, or is it a terrestrial business? And they're using software and data for things that are happening in space or space hardware, but it's actually no different than a company making software for some 3D printing, say, here on Earth.
Yeah, I think it's more the latter, David. I think it's a terrestrial business. And why do I say that? I say that because the telemetry, the data, doesn't necessarily even have to come from space. It could come from drones. It could come from low-flying aircraft. It could come from fixed balloons that are floating over different parts of the Earth measuring water vapor or whatever the case may be. So it isn't inherently a space business. But the reason it's relevant to space is it's driving huge economic value creation, which in turn is driving a lot of demand for things like launch, things like spacecraft, things like spacecraft services. So, you know, when you look at any industry, you need an economic engine to power investment. And a lot of the investment, even launch, is directly tied to the data that that spacecraft ultimately creates and the value it ultimately creates for products and services on a terrestrial basis. So it is a terrestrial business in that context, but in some ways it doesn't matter because it's going to drive capital investment that's going to have benefits to not only the direct space verticals that we've been talking about, but even other space verticals that aren't necessarily directly line of sight associated with data, but nevertheless benefit from all the investment that's flowing into it.
So if you're a young entrepreneur and you want to start up a space company, what would you start?
You know, it's a great question. I would focus on one element of the hyperspectral data set that's being built. So whether it's optical, which is pretty crowded right now, be it, you know, at the high end with Digital Globe and maybe at the low end Planet and others, to SAR, which is synthetic aperture radar, which of course can see under clouds and has been demilitarized to a certain extent, which has created some business opportunities. So that would be companies like ISAI, for example. To other spectra, whether it's infrared or other constellations that are going up, I would focus on owning one of those spectra. And I think being best in class within that would be important. And if you're best in class within that particular spectra, my thesis all along is you'll have a large data provider, you know, like a Facebook, for example, to me would be a likely candidate, who is essentially inherently a data firm that would then start aggregating the spectra, you know, whether it's SAR, optical, whatever the case may be, because there's actually a multiplier effect, right? If you have layers and layers and layers of data, if you can see above clouds, below clouds, through clouds, if you can measure moisture, if you can measure optical, if you can measure infrared, if you can measure heat, you get a multiplier effect as you keep stacking those data layers. And so I guess my recommendation would be to own one of those. The other thing that they could do, which would be also interesting, is just making sure that you have best-in-class spacecraft. And what do I mean by best-in-class? Again, it's back to sort of that three-variable equation we talked about with the launch. It's not a Six Sigma spacecraft necessarily. It's a spacecraft that's designed perfectly for the functional task at hand, but also ensures that it's on Moore's Law, meaning that you're building a new version every 12 to 18 months, let's say, as opposed to every 10 years, and can allow, you know, for maximum, you know, value engineering, if you will. And I think that's one of the things that Planet has done really successfully with their Dove program. I mean, I think initially, you know, people were concerned about maybe some of the reliability of the Doves, but the fact of the matter is they only need about 80% of those things to work at any given time to still have a full ubiquitous constellation around Earth. And you can do things now, of course, like update the software and do version control and things like that that actually make the spacecraft much more functional. And, you know, we compare that model to, let's say, a Digital Globe model where you're putting up a satellite every, you know, 8 to 10 years or so. And I just think given, you know, the fact that we're still iterating from a hardware and software standpoint so rapidly, I think the Planet model and models like it are much more prone, you know, to catch, if you will, the market leaders within a particular spectra just because they're iterating and innovating so quickly.
So at, for example, the New Space Conference, and there were all these panels with entrepreneurs that were there, it seems to me that there's a lot of duplication going on with imaging and CubeSats doing somewhat of the same thing, maybe going after similar markets. I didn't pick up on people going after markets and niches like you're talking about right now. So did I miss something, or did you come away with a similar assessment?
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, there are definitely, I think, a huge number of company formations within Earth observation, some of which are public, some of which are I mean, the better ones I'm aware of, David, are actually in stealth mode and don't do panels and don't sort of broadcast what they're doing, which, you know, I think, you know, something can be said for that approach, right? You sort of prove the model when you're actually launching hardware and collecting data.
Yeah, I actually agree with that approach. But
yeah, and I think that I don't want to say the smarter ones, because that infers that the ones that are doing panels aren't smart. That's not what I mean. But what I would say is, not everything that is on a panel captures necessarily what's happening. Maybe that's the broader point. I'm in a unique position just because a lot of people will reach out to me for my input. So I see a lot of those business plans ahead of time. And I would tell you, it is getting very crowded. I don't think it's necessarily a winner-take-all market, though. And why do I say that? I say that because the amount of data that's being collected versus the amount of data that could be collected, I mean, it's literally orders of magnitude difference. So I think we're several years away from, you know, perfect, hyperspectral, ubiquitous, always-on information about the Earth. And I think there's going to have to be many, 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 many more constellations launched, refined, the data mined before we're even close to being saturated. That being said, not every company's going to make it, and certainly there's going to be some overlap. There's no doubt about that. But I think we're years away from it being saturated.
Now, I have another one for you that kind of has a comedy overtone, but it does gnaw on me every time I hear it. And, Dylan, I do hear it a lot. And I heard it a lot at the Starship conference that I was at, although that really wasn't a commercial business conference. But I heard it from many of the people on the stage at New Space, and that is that they want these space businesses because they want to save humanity, or they want to save the world, or they want to do something that just, I don't know, transforms or improves or does something to the world based on how they see what the world needs or what they want to contribute. You know, I kid around on the show that these are all these companies and individuals singing Kumbaya together. But do you come across that for real in the business world, or is this an artifact of these people coming up on panels and wanting to portray that they're doing something for a global benefit? I have no idea how they're going to save the world or what it is that they're doing that's going to save the world. But I hear it all the time, you must hear it too. Is this for real in the business world, or is this just kind of like a panel artifact?
Yeah, well, look, it's the question, right? I mean, ultimately, I think there are a lot of kindred spirits. I would include myself as one of them, in terms of wanting certain outcomes for space and certain outcomes for our species and all that. I think, though, there are people who have a practical approach to how to make that happen, and there are other people who lament the fact that it hasn't happened. What I would say is, in my mind, the best way to ensure that we open space and sort of our, you know, destiny, if I can use that term, is fulfilled in a meaningful way, is to make sure that the economics of space are sustainable. And if the economics of space are sustainable, and this is where I would, you know, cite Jeff Bezos, who I deeply admire, about this vision of having tens of thousands, even millions of people working and living in space. When he says that, he's not talking about, I don't think, or certainly based upon what he has said, I don't think he's saying this, that this is some kind of program to get these folks into space. It's a economic engine that's powering that, that's enabling that. And so, you know, we talked quite a bit about Earth observation. I'm not deeply passionate about Earth observation, but I am deeply passionate about the fact that it's a value creator. And the fact that it's a value creator helps open up space, helps open up launch, helps open up in-space services. And it has all these other ancillary benefits to all these other, I think, very valid and very noble goals. But these valid and noble goals can only be enabled by sustainable economic incentives, in my mind. If there's another way, I'm all for it, and I'm open to a conversation about it. But I'm not sure what that would be. And so I think the capital flows are critical. And the capital flows, as we've talked about before, David, and we talked about it in December, you know, companies like Sequoia and other VCs, you know, they're all, and they should be, because it's their charter. This is what they're in business for. Their investment decisions are based upon economic returns. Right? I mean, that's
right, of course.
And it has to be. And they wouldn't be Sequoia if they had conducted themselves any differently. They wouldn't be the leader in their industry. So it's a long-winded way of saying, you know, I appreciate the ethos that goes behind those comments, but I think, you know, like I said, I think there's a practical enabling sort of ethos, and then there's more of a lamenting ethos. And I'm, at least myself, I'll speak for myself, I think it's more productive to try to look for ways to create sustainable economic drivers to help open space. I think that's a key thing.
So I do come across people who don't understand capital flows. And, for example, they think space mining will end up stopping people from appreciating and valuing space because it'll only be for the elites that get to retain the territory that they're mining and making profits on only for themselves. I find it very hard to talk with them about capital flows and how economic systems work, and that people aren't going to invest and develop unless there are some kind of returns down the line that are other than social returns of, I guess, income distribution. I'm sort of putting words in their mouth, but that's how I see it, and they don't refute it. And I do hear from those people on the Space Show, and I do hear from them at conferences, and it does trouble me. So I don't know if there's if we're not doing a good job in talking accurately and maybe inspiringly, if that's a word, about what commercial space and sustainable economics can do for people, because we're not reaching a lot of people, and I don't know if it's really important, Dylan, that we reach all these people, because I don't know what quantity of people or what subsectors of people you need to reach in order to make sure that commercial space and the things that we're talking about can thrive and can progress and sustainable economics can continue to develop. I don't know if you need to reach 90% of the people or just the people in our little part of the world, you know. But I hear these comments all the time, and they do trouble me, and I do find that it's really difficult to have these discussions with them, and it's even more difficult to change somebody's mind.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, I have maybe a slightly different view on that, David. I mean, I do think it is important that we engage with everybody, even people that have different views on these kinds of things, and hear them out and try to understand where they're coming from. I do think you've hit on an important topic, which is, it's almost like sort of fundamental economics. And that is, if you start with the end goal, which is the end goal is to have a commercial space sector that is doing interesting things in space and enabling humanity to go off the Earth into Luna, Mars, deep space, whatever the case may be. If that's the goal, and I think most of the people that would attend those kinds of conferences would share that goal. Otherwise, I'm not sure why they would be there.
No, they do, but they don't have a clear idea of the economics of making that happen.
Yeah, I mean, that would be sort of my retort to them is, look, I'm totally open-minded to having a conversation about the good and bad of capitalism and how we safely navigate that. I think that's a healthy conversation, but the whole notion that we can't engage, you know, investment or return on investment or these kinds of concepts to open up space, I'm not sure how you open it up without those concepts. If there's another way, I'm all for it. I don't know what that would be. And the other thing I would say, David, and you know all these people personally as well, I know the people running these companies, whether it's a deep space or Planetary Resources or these other companies. And these are good people, right? These aren't people that are looking to exploit humanity and run us into a ditch. So I think you know, a lot of it has to do with the people that are engaged in these activities. And it seems to me that some of the folks that are making those comments would probably need to get to know, you know, some of the people that are running these companies, because I just don't see any of the sort of malevolent behavior that they're projecting on these companies. I just don't see it personally, and I know these guys really well.
You have an email, the first one of the day that I'm reading, from Ted, who is in Las Vegas, and he says, I'm a little bit disappointed, but not very much surprised, his language, that you haven't mentioned any possible business opportunities or commercial opportunities involving human spaceflight. Before I close the book on any kind of near-term or moderate-term human spaceflight commercial opportunities, are there any?
Yeah, no, I think there are. I think there are. I mean, it's a very exciting sector. The two, you know, probably most interesting near-term opportunities are Worldview, which, of course, is not, it's below the Kármán line, right? This is stratosphere travel.
Right.
And full disclosure, I'm an investor in Worldview. Quite interesting. They're doing some really interesting things. The thing I like about that particular opportunity and the reason I think it will sell well is it's a, you know, 4 to 5 hour experience, 7 to 8 people in the capsule. I think you can really sort of take in elements of the overview effect and really have a profound experience, as opposed to maybe the Virgin flight, which I don't know a ton about, but, you know, you're more strapped in, you're more, you know, pulling several G's. You know, if you and I went together, David, we might not necessarily even be able to see each other across a spacecraft. So I think Worldview has a lot of potential, and I like the technology that they've employed. But the other one, of course, is Blue Origin, and I think we've all now seen the capsule at one space show or another, and to me that is incredibly interesting. And, you know, one thing I know about Jeff Bezos and Blue in general is they're, you know, a so-called measure twice, cut once type culture. So I'm confident when that thing starts to fly, it's going to be safe, it's going to be reliable. I think it'll be economical, although it's anybody's guess. And of course, economical is a relative term. But that's not necessarily an investment opportunity because, of course, that's a self-funded vehicle. Worldview, of course, would be. What I think is even more interesting than that, though, is this whole notion of, you know, true space travel. You know, the ISS, you know, it's reported a ticket to the ISS is, you know, depending on what article you read, $20 to $40 million. To me, the question is, how do we get that down to something like $5 million? Because I think the number of people who would actually do something like that to a private space station, whether it's Axiom or Bigelow or whatever the case may be, I think that's a pretty high number that would be interested in that. So I think there are things happening with Commercial Crew, with Blue, with Worldview, with Virgin, all of which are going to happen in the next 12 to 18 months. And I know the running joke is it's always 12 to 18 months away, but I really do believe that, David, that we're certainly by the end of next year, we're going to be minting new astronauts above the Kármán line. I think that will happen. I think space tourism will become much more, you know, much hotter as a sector. But right now, it's really, in terms of investment, really the only game in town is Worldview. You know, Virgin's not taking third-party capital, as far as I know, and, of course, Blue Origin's not either. We do have the private space station, Axiom, out there raising money, and some other, I'll call them stealth business plans that I've seen that I'm not in a position to talk about. So there are some things kicking around, but nothing, you know, fair point by the person who sent the email, nothing, you know, front page news at this point in terms of capital being raised. I agree with that.
Going out a little bit longer term, do you see any real opportunities vis-a-vis space settlement?
Well, yes. It depends on how we define long term. But yeah, no, I think it all really depends on how Luna shapes up over this next 12 to 18 months. I mean, it looks like Astrobotic is going to launch. Certainly, they have their ride set up. Moon Express has said that they're going to launch as well. Chinese might even, you know, meet that time frame as well, depending on who and what you believe. So theoretically, we could have two private spacecraft and one, one Chinese spacecraft on the moon in fiscal year 2018. So I think that would be quite interesting, and I think that would generate a lot of activity, both investment activity, but also future business planning activity in terms of, you know, what might be possible. Mars, of course, depending, and that's why I said, David, it depends on how you define long term. I do think Mars is going to happen. I do think Elon is essentially betting the farm on it, and I think it's his primary passion as far as I can tell. So I do think that is going to happen. It's just a matter of time. You know, I think he's, correct me if I have this wrong, but I think he's saying 2023. That seems pretty aggressive to me, but then again, a lot of what he has said in the past seems aggressive, and he's delivered on most of it. So, but yeah, no, I think settlement is definitely in the cards. You know, I'm sort of with Bezos a bit on settlement, and that is, I'm not sure why you would climb out of one gravity well to get deep into another. So to me, a lot of the in-space infrastructure is going to be important. And to me, you know, if I were creating a business plan focused on settlement, I think it would be more of an in-space settlement community than let's say, on Mars or the moon. And it's not to say that those Mars and the moon shouldn't happen. I just think it's going to be much more of an enabling next step to have something in space, build the resources up there, than it will be to build it in a gravity well.
So I do know that Al Globus, I don't know if you know Al or not, you probably do.
I don't.
Well, he has talked about these low Earth orbit over the equatorial zone, belts for orbiting space stations that are in very low radiation belts. Mm-hmm. So, and he's talked about that as being much more plausible than going to the surface of the moon, for example, or certainly Mars. But they still are dependent upon Earth. They're not Earth independent.
Mm-hmm.
Does being, if any of these orbital infrastructure stations do get developed, does being Earth-dependent interfere with their potential commercial profitability?
No. I mean, I'd have to reflect on that a bit, David. But no, inherently, I don't think so. I mean, there are several reasons for settlement, right? I mean, I think Elon would say, or I've heard him say something similar to this, that his primary driver is diversification. Right, to have the DNA off the Earth. And I think that's a very valid and sound reason for settlement. It resonates with me personally, but it wouldn't be my primary driver. My primary driver would be more along the lines of, you know, can we create a sustainable, element of humanity elsewhere in the stars, whether it's Titan or whether it's at a Lagrangian point between the moon and the Earth or whatever the case may be. So it's more sort of demonstrating this ability to pursue the new frontier. And I think in that context, it's probably more important to be independent of the Earth-Moon system, I think, to demonstrate that as sort of a model that's sustainable. But I think all of them are going to have to exist, David, because they're all, in many respects, symbiotic with each other. But I think ultimately, you know, back to the economics, just to get grounded here for a second, what are going to drive the economics of in space? I think it's going to be people who want to go. So this would be sort of the Mars tickets that Elon would sell. But it is also going to be driven, and this is, gets back to what you said earlier with the people at the conference, it's going to be driven by resources, because that's where a lot of the value creation is going to be. And by definition, you need people to buy those resources. So I think, you know, at least for the foreseeable future, the next 50 to 100 years, I don't see any economic model that's not tied back to the Earth. I think ultimately the Earth still has to be sort of the main, you know, trading market, if you will. And you know, we've talked about, I think you and I talked on the last show, or I've spoken with others about this, you know, the moon really being the eighth continent. I think that's right. I think thinking about the moon as a economic subset of the global economic system on Earth, I think that's the right way to think about it. I think it's more of a continental view, at least in the kind of medium term. Long term, I think you would have independent sort of economic systems, but I think that's a ways out.
Jack is in Tucson with an email question. And he says there is a lot of talk about somehow building a routine or close to routine cislunar transportation system. Many talk about this being a public-private partnership, but mostly public, sort of an infrastructure deal, like, say, the interstate highways. Do you think commercial companies could today provide a routine, fairly frequent cislunar transportation system, and could it survive economically as a private business, or does it need to be at least quasi-government?
Yeah, so it depends. If we're talking about material, I think it could and should be commercial in nature, and I think it is sustainable, potentially. And certainly Moon Express and Astrobotic are sort of betting on those models. If it's human, I think that's a very heavy lift because, you know, a lot needs to happen between now and setting that up. I don't see a public-private partnership making that happen anytime soon. I just don't think the politics would enable, you know, a spend of that nature. Medium to long term, yeah, I think obviously there is going to have to be some sort of a human transport system put in place. If I was a betting man, I would say that would be commercial in nature, but I don't see that happening anytime soon. I mean, we need to fully commercialize LEO before we step out into Luna, in my mind.
Alice is in Seattle, and Alice says, do you see in the future, let's talk near term, which for me will be, let's say, 3 to 7 years, that sectors of the world or other countries will be significant contributors to the commercial development of space, or is this mostly going to be a U.S.-driven effort?
I certainly hope so. I really love that question. You know, my day job, David, is, I don't think we spend a ton of time talking about it, is running a global company, and so 95% of the time I'm thinking in a global context where the U.S. is just a player amongst, you know, 68 countries that we operate in. Space is you know, unfortunately, I would use that term, very North American-centric at the least. I do see that changing, and I think it's really, really important it does change. And why do I say that? A couple reasons. When we talk about economics and capital flows, obviously the U.S. is a wealthy nation, but you know, it doesn't have all the world's wealth, and a lot of these projects that we're talking about are going to take significant capital. So I think the more global the space industry is, the better the economics ultimately become. So I think it's critical for that reason. Second reason is for some of the reasons we talked about earlier in terms of getting people on board, getting people to understand the overall vision for commercial space, why and how it benefits humanity. If that's a purely a U.S. conversation, I think it makes it much more difficult to make the argument that this benefits all of humankind. And then the third is, you know, some of our legacy within space, you know, others would argue most of our legacy within space is inherently conflict and sort of, based in military thinking. And I think that's always going to have an element, of course. I mean, we live in a world that has dangers and risks and certainly bad actors. There's no doubt about that. But I don't think the whole space conversation should be dominated by sort of military concerns. I think having a more global commercial view is important, certainly to mitigate some of the you know, fears that people have, that we're just going to project a lot of our problems into space over time. So I think it's critical that it does become more global. To answer your question, do I think it will be? Yes. Ultimately, I think it will be. I think right now we're seeing hints of that, you know, mainly within sort of the nomenclature and some of the space shows that are being done and things like that. I'm not seeing a lot of global investors coming into space companies based in the U.S., and I'm not seeing a lot of U.S.-based investors investing in companies overseas. So I think that is an opportunity, and it's certainly something that I want to personally focus on because it's important for all the reasons I just mentioned.
Are you seeing entrepreneurs coming from other parts of the world, other countries?
I am. Yeah, no, I'm seeing a huge number of what I would call business plans or business ideas coming from Europe, a few from Asia. Asia is really interesting because, you know, in some respects it's even more, I don't know what the right term is, complicated than other parts of the world, just given some of the geopolitical issues that are driving some of the countries over there between Japan and China, for example, India, and some of the other countries that are involved in space. So I would say it's primarily Europe right now that I'm seeing the entrepreneurs, but I am seeing a couple of folks from Asia submit business plans, talk about startups. I think you might have saw Astroscale, which is one of the companies looking at moving space debris, which is now Singaporean-based. They're really a Japanese company, but based in Singapore. I think raised something like $20 million recently. So we are seeing, you know, some companies emerge there that are going to be, I think, quite influential in the future commercial space.
Dylan, we're past our halfway point, so I'm going to take our break right here, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
And listeners, we'll be back in a couple of minutes and look forward to hearing from you. Again, if your phone line is available and you want to give us a call, it is 1-866-687-7223. And we should be back in a couple of minutes. Don't go anywhere.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space.
And welcome back, everybody, to part two of our Sunday Space Show program. You can give us a call if you would like, 1-866-687-7223. And email drspace, drspace at thespaceshow.com. Our corporate sponsors bringing us today's program in the second part are Orbital ATK, a global leader in aerospace and defense technologies, and they are referred to as a partner you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense programs. Also, AIAA, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. And remember, if you're going to be at the Space 2017 AIAA meeting in Orlando, which I believe is September 11th through the 14th, do let me know. I will be there. Would love to meet up and connect with you. Check AIAA out at AIAA.org. Great organization. And then Celestis is also our sponsor. And they are the iconic pioneer, and they're still the only provider of space burial services. And they have a very active launch program for this year. Rocket Lab's Electron launcher is going to lift off from New Zealand with a spacecraft bound for the moon. And aboard will be Moon Express, but also the remains of many with their DNA samples as well from Celestis participants on a worldwide basis. This is the second Celestis lunar mission because the first one was back in 1998 in which Eugene Shoemaker's remains went to the moon. Celestis is going to lead a group of intrepid family members to New Zealand to view the launch. It's got a lot of other activities available, and if you are thinking about a space burial of some sort for your loved one, this is a small amount of DNA or something similar. Check them out at Celestis, CELESTIS.com. And again, in the manner of disclosure, I am a Celestis customer, a very, very happy one, not in the sense that I get to use their services. Nobody wants to use the funeral service, but their service is just amazing. Really great people. Dylan, economic downturns, we hear the stock market may be in a bubble and it's all hell's going to break loose at some point. How vulnerable is this commercial space excitement to what happens with the stock market and the economy? And I might throw in government policy just for fun.
Well, let's cover government policy at the end. I think the general stock market matters, of course. The sentiment matters because a lot of investors, be they angel investors or venture capitalists or private equity firms, ultimately are impacted by general economic sentiment. To me, the key thing is interest rates. You know, interest rates remain historically low, incredibly low. Monetary policy, of course, has a lot to do with that. But as long as interest rates are, you know, call it sub 5% for the 10-year, I don't see commercial space investment cratering. I do see it being impacted, of course, by general economic activity and certainly geopolitics. Obviously, if there was a conflict, if there was some kind of, heaven forbid, an attack or anything like that, that, of course, could shut things down pretty dramatically. That being said, I think a lot of the companies that are operating right now aren't necessarily capital constrained. You know, if I look at some of the larger, more successful space companies, I think they've raised the kinds of funds that they've needed to raise, and perhaps even a little bit more than they needed, wisely. You know, I think you make hay when you can, and then, you know, if things are impacted, you have enough economic resources to sort of see through the storm. You know, government policy, of course, drives a lot. You know, it's obviously the largest customer by far for space in general. So I think policy matters. We still don't know necessarily, you know, who the administrator is going to be, what the Trump policy might be on the moon, for example. Things like that could impact not necessarily the quanta of investment, but where that investment is directed. And so, obviously, people are very keen to know what that policy is, and not only what the policy is, but get a read on whether it is a fleeting sort of declaration, or is it something they can really point the boat towards? You know, is it a lighthouse that they can point the boat towards for 3 to 4 to 5 years, or is it going to change in 6 months or 12 months? If they think it's more the latter, they're very unlikely to invest because they don't want the goalpost to change, obviously.
How easy is it to determine if it's going to be sort of iffy and questionable, or if the Trump administration means it and it will be long-lasting? Are there some things that you've learned to look at to give you an idea on the viability of government policy over the years?
Yeah, I mean, it is a black box, but I think a couple things, David. Look for inconsistencies. So if the policy, for example, doesn't have economic viability, or it's presupposing increases that aren't likely going to happen, either for political reasons or otherwise, that would be an inconsistency. Depending on who the administrator is, and you know, are they more commercially oriented? Are they more traditionally oriented? Things of that nature. And the strategy, let's say, presupposes or assumes a viable commercial push, but yet the administrator doesn't have that background. That would be another inconsistency. So I think most people look for, does the story line up with the resources, line up with the people? And if the story, resources, and people line up, then I think you have a reasonable certainty that at least it's going to trend in that direction. If they don't line up, I think people don't believe it.
You have another email from listener Adrian, who is in San Diego. As with other historical, as I would call fanciful technologies, such as at the time cold fusion energy claims, we are now being saturated by so-called exotic space propulsion schemes I collectively class under the M-Drive umbrella. My question is, do you see any investors putting their faith in any of these questionable startups or potential business plans involving such schemes, or, in my opinion, scams?
Yeah. I haven't seen an M-Drive business plan funded.
Have you seen an M-Drive business plan?
I have. I've seen two. And I've actually seen one that wasn't even a business plan. It was more of a sort of a charitable request, you know, saying, hey, I want to do this. Will you back it? Which I declined. So there are business plans out there. I haven't seen any of them funded. You know, whether M-Drive is real or not real, we could debate. But even if it is real, let's assume it's real for a second, that doesn't necessarily mean that people are going to rush to fund it, because it, you know, you need to understand who's the team, what's the plan, what kind of hardware is being contemplated, where's the testing happening, things of that nature. I'm not seeing too many more. I mean, I guess, take that back. I have seen a couple of business plans that are, you know, nuclear based and things like that that just aren't going to happen, because they're not going to be allowed to be, to happen. But that being said, there are a lot of propulsion systems out there that are very legitimate. I mean, the one that comes to mind, which you probably heard of, David, is Axion Systems out of, which is a spinoff out of MIT, which I'm an investor in. That's in space propulsion. That's a really interesting system, really interesting technology. It's legit from my point of view, and that's a fully funded business plan. So that one's pretty exciting. And then there's other traditional in-space propulsion systems like Hall Effect and other things that are proven, where people have plans to just make those technologies better or more readily available. So I do think in-space propulsion is something of interest. I'm seeing more and more business plans associated with it. There was an announcement this week between Axion and York Space Systems. York is another company that I've invested in, but those two companies have come together to partner to do in-space propulsion. So I do think there's going to be more and more economic activity associated with that. Whether it's M-Drive or not, I'm skeptical that any of those plans would get funded, but we'll see.
Were the M-Drive business plans that you saw total crap, or did they have merit, or how would you assess them?
The one that was a charitable request actually had merit. I thought it was well thought out. It didn't make any claims that I thought were inherently dubious. I was a little bit concerned as to whether that team was the right team to pull it off. That was my primary concern, and that's why ultimately I passed. But it was well thought out. The other two business plans were, in my opinion, not well thought out, and we're just sort of using M-Drive as really a buzz term, I thought, to raise money.
Have you seen a business plan come through for Warp Drive yet?
I haven't. But I have seen very exotic ideas. You know, like you, David, I get stuff in the mail, you know, 100 pages thick, some treatise that some person's written or whatever. So I do get stuff like that. That's pretty crazy from time to time, but for the most part, what I get is pretty well thought out.
Linda's in Portland, Oregon, and she said, I believe Mars One is somewhat of a commercial venture, but it hasn't been mentioned yet. Do you believe that Mars One is commercially viable?
To be honest, I don't know much about Mars One. I know it is a publicly traded entity in Europe, as I understand it. I've been told by others that its primary source of revenue right now is really marketing, sponsorships, and things of that nature. So I'm probably not the right person to comment on it, David. Obviously, anything that gets commercial space opened up, gets people into space, I'm all for. But as an investor, I wasn't asked to look at their business plan. Like I said, they're publicly traded.
Whoa. Where is Mars One publicly traded?
I think it's on one of the smaller European exchanges.
On a European, not an American exchange.
No, not on an American exchange. I think it... And by the way, that's secondhand, David.
No, I think you're right. I think I remember getting a newsletter that they're on some Dutch over-the-counter equivalent type of thing.
I think that's right. So I probably shouldn't comment, David, just because I don't.
Sure,
I don't
you should. That's what we love on this.
Well, I don't know the team. You know, I would say the reputation within the investor community is skepticism about Mars One. But if you ask me why, I couldn't point to a single thing as to what's generating that skepticism. But I think in general, there's a heavy amount of skepticism as to whether that's a viable company or not.
I don't think it's viable. We could spend the rest of the afternoon talking about why it's not viable, but it's probably not worth it by any means. Do you see SpaceX doing an IPO soon, and would they open up for investment their Mars plans?
Yeah, well, all speculation, so I don't know. But I would say, ultimately, if you look at the ambition for the Mars plan, I think they have to raise third-party capital in quanta that's much higher than they've raised in the past, in my opinion. There was an announcement recently, I don't know if you saw, Luke Nosek, who was with Founders Fund, is starting this new fund, and supposedly that fund is primarily raising money for SpaceX, although I'm not sure SpaceX ever confirmed that. I know Luke, he's an incredibly capable guy. He was an early founder of PayPal and very, very, very well known in the Valley. So that could be an indication of them gearing up to raise additional money. Don't know. That's speculation. Will they go public? I think ultimately, so, you know, why do companies go public? You know, in general, it's because they can't raise enough money privately to fund their business plans. That's one reason. Another reason might be to create liquidity for the shareholders so they're able to take some chips off the table, so to speak. I don't think Elon needs that second category, so I think the only reason he would do it would be to raise more money than he has in the past. I think that's why Tesla went public. So I think it's a possibility. I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon, only because I think SpaceX, you know, my understanding is they've raised another $325 million. At a $20+ billion valuation that was published recently. If that's the case, I would imagine that they are going to be fine for the next, you know, 18 to 24 months. That being said, you don't go public in a down market typically because it's hard to underwrite deals in a down market. So what I would say is if they don't go public, you know, in the next 24 months, I think there's a high likelihood we have an economic downturn and they have to wait for the next cycle to go public. So I'm sure all these things are in their mind as they sort of make that decision, but those would be the considerations.
You have Robert, who is sitting someplace in the Chicago area, and Robert said, if you consider space to be a risky investment, and some of the risk factors are possible regulation and environment plus other risk elements, if you compared space to a terrestrial risk investment of comparable risk features, and assuming the markets were roughly the same potential, would you have a preference of investing in space because you're a space geek? Or would you go to space because you think it's there with the merit over the terrestrial investment? Or would you stay with terrestrial investment?
Well, speaking for myself, I'm primarily involved in space as an investor because I love space. So full disclosure, that's my primary driver. But I don't think it's the primary driver for Sequoia or Lightspeed or some of these other very smart investors who have come in recently. All investment obviously is risky unless you're buying a T-bill. But certainly the most risky investment you can possibly engage in as an individual is early stage angel investing. And that's primarily where I've focused my attention. And, you know, typically, you know, 8 out of 10 of those investments traditionally would be zeros, would be total wipeouts. And that's why a traditional angel investor would look for something like a 10 to 15x return. And if they can't see that kind of potential, they wouldn't typically invest. And the reason for that is because of the high, very, very high, you know, flame out rate, if I can use that pun, for space investments. I'm not seeing that level of failure rate within space. It's probably closer to 50%, if even that. Now, you could argue that's because these companies are newly minted. They haven't had enough time to succeed or fail. But right now, I would say space, ironically, is holding up better as an angel sector than other risky sectors like software or telecom or something like that. We'll see how that plays out in the long run, but right now I would say it's holding up really well. And the whole notion, I think, David, we covered this on the last call, the whole reason I got personally involved as a space angel was really because of the goal to try to get more later stage capital involved in space, more venture capital and more private equity. And my thesis at the time, together with a handful of other people, this was probably 8 or 9 years ago, is that unless and until you had a successful angel community successfully minting companies that could develop to a stage where the VCs were interested, that you couldn't have a successful ecosystem. That was the thesis. So to me, I'm very, very, very gratified that we're now seeing mainstream venture capitalists come into the sector, because to me it sort of validates focus that we had on angel capital. And, of course, the angel sector within space has never been more robust as well. It's very, very, very active, and we're getting people from many, many, many successful investors from outside of space that are now looking at space companies.
Barbara is in Tucson, and she says you also have yet to mention the economic potential, if you believe there is one, on the deep space mining ventures. Any thoughts on that as a venture? Is it too far out, meaning very long term? What are your thoughts?
The mega headline is it's a $1 trillion opportunity. There's no doubt about that. And when people say space resources is a $1 trillion industry and there might be a trillionaire down the road from space resources, I believe that. The issue is when. And I don't see that happening in the next 10 years. I just don't. But what I do see happening is deep space resource mining and the infrastructure associated with that being in situ, in space, mining resources like water, which of course is rocket fuel as we know, building point-to-point communication, getting in-space manufacturing up and running, and doing all the other things that we know will need to be done to enable a space economy. So again, it's a little bit like data for Earth observation. It's sort of the siphon mechanism, if you will, that is bringing capital into a sector that's building infrastructure, you know, for ultimately the brass ring way down the road. But there are a lot of interim steps in there that have a benefit not only to space resources but to other industries within space.
So if property rights don't emerge through all these outer space treaty discussions over the coming years, does that hinder deep space mining profit potential? Or do you think being content with the way the outer space treaty is worded now would work just fine?
I think people are comforted, investors are comforted by a couple things. One is the Space Act, which was passed, when was that, end of 15?
Yeah, end of 15. Uh-huh.
Many of our friends, David, were involved in that. that gave us some comfort. What Luxembourg has done recently has given some comfort. I know the UN or parts of the UN are talking about these kinds of issues in a constructive way, from what I understand. That gives us some comfort. So I don't, again, it's not riskless, right?
Right.
Even if there's a property right, it doesn't mean someone can't seize your land, right? Even in this country or any other country, the regimes change, times change, and you're always kind of at the will of the system and the courts and all of that. So I think what investors are looking for is, are there any obvious signs that we're going to have a regulatory risk? I mean, that's sort of the euphemism, right?
Right.
And I think right now people are reasonably comfortable. The Space Act, even though we could argue how much it was in substance, it gave people a great comfort because it was sort of a refresh of, okay, this topic has been raised, people have talked about it, and the politics seem to hold together. It's very U.S.-centric, as we know, by definition. It was passed by U.S. Congress. But I think that gave people a lot of comfort.
You'll know we've come alive when you'll see the first U.S. IRS forfeiture case of space assets for somebody that
right.
the IRS is after, and they seize your lunar or deep space mining assets. Then you know that space mining and commerce will have finally arrived when the IRS wants it, right? And, you know, maybe that'll be forthcoming down the road. Who knows? We are coming up close to the end of the show. What should we have talked about? What have we missed? What should we know? Or what should we ask you that we don't even know we should ask you?
You know, one of the things we haven't talked about in the past, and I'll just leave you to think about and the listeners, is how much does basic science research drive commercial innovation in space? I mean, we were joking about M-Drive earlier.
Uh-huh.
Let's put M-Drive aside. I noticed Leonard David wrote a great piece on a space resources program that Colorado School of Mines is now launching, which I thought was really interesting. You've got one of the top mining universities in the world having a space resources program. And, you know, doing basic research on, you know, methods of extracting materials, methods of spacecraft propulsion, you know, things of that nature, I think, are relevant. I know the University of Texas, University of Arizona, and others are working on things like space debris. So I think there's a big role for basic research and the university systems to play in commercial space and enabling these technologies. And LEO Labs, for example, David, which we've talked about in the past, was a spinoff from the Stanford Research Institute, you know, indexing space debris and the like. So I think a productive dialogue, and it might be appropriate for the show to have some leading academics on the show, and maybe you've done this, talking about basic space research. I think that could be a real enabler for commercial space as well, especially if it's done in a coordinated way. So I don't think we spend a ton of time as an industry talking about that, and I think it's important.
Do any academics come to mind?
You know, yeah, Moriba Jha, who's now at Texas.
Yeah, he's been on the show before.
Yeah, Moriba, you know, is a friend and a good person. Lawrence Krauss is doing some interesting things at Arizona State, if you know Lawrence.
Yeah, he hasn't been on for a while, but yeah, he's been on the show several times.
Yeah, and there's some up-and-comers. I mean, Dante Larada, who's running the OSIRIS-REx program at University of Arizona, really interesting guy, if you haven't talked to him.
No, I've not talked to him.
Yeah, he's really interesting as well. So there, you know, and I'm sure there's hundreds of others that I wouldn't know just because I haven't sought them out. But I do think there's an opportunity for academia to drive a lot of this basic research. And frankly, a lot of the business plans I get are coming out of, you know, PhD programs at Stanford and places like that.
Well, are they showing economics and profitability for basic research?
Yeah, I don't know about the basic research question. I would tell you the quality of the business plans I'm getting from PhD programs, in particular Stanford, are remarkable. I mean, they're as good as anything that I'm seeing anywhere. So, and that's sort of where the impetus of the idea was coming from, is I think if we had more focus for relevant basic research at universities, I think it could almost have an incubator effect for some of these business plans.
Are you seeing anything for medical research, basic medical research coming from space?
No, I haven't seen any of that, although a lot of the data that we, products and services we've been talking about have huge medical implications on the machine learning front. So there is some synergy at the data level, but no, I'm not seeing any like microgravity or anything like that, quite yet. I'd love to see more of that, and maybe that's an area of, opportunity.
Government funding of science programs and getting government grants, does that interfere with the commercial side of what you're talking about?
No, I think that's all beneficial. I think National Science Foundation, SBIR programs, all that stuff is, I think, important. Because ultimately what you're trying to do is you're trying to increase company formation. Right? Think of it as just a big funnel. The more company formations you have, the better, you know, business plans you have, which ultimately lead to the best company formations, which lead to the best ultimate outcomes. So I just think of it in terms of almost like a pipeline. And at the end of the day, you want more company formations. That's, I think, a healthy thing for the industry.
So, Dylan, we have about 3 minutes left. So, let's assume we're doing this show 10 years from today, and how would it be different?
Well, I'm an optimist, David, as you know. So I think we will have a vibrant space economy. If we think of space as the eighth continent, which I like to kind of use that moniker, I think it would be, you know, on par with the Americas or with Asia Pacific in terms of economic activity in 10 years. I've said in the past, and I'll repeat it, that 10% of the world GDP will be space-related by 2030. I believe that. You know, the economy in 2030 globally should be about $120 trillion, round numbers. It's $80 trillion today. So if it's $120 trillion and 10% of space, that would be a $12 trillion economy in space. I think we'll have a lot more people with their astronaut wings. I think we have 536 today, which is tragic in my mind, and I think it's what 24 people have seen the Earth in totality since the beginning of human creation, which is pretty unbelievable when you think about it. So let me make a guess. I think we'll have over 100,000 people who have seen the Earth in its totality in 10 years. Maybe that's a good goal.
Wow, that's huge. So most of those are going to be private, obviously.
I think so. I mean, I think Mars will happen between now and then. I think something on Luna will happen between now and then. I think we'll have a private space station between now and then, probably several. I mean, 10 years is a long time. Just look at what's happened in the last 18 months.
I know. It's almost unbelievable what's happened in that period of time.
Yeah, it really is.
And it's really taken off. So if we go back in time, can you, in the remaining time, say that there was one single event that turned all of this on, that opened up the spigot?
You know, I'll oversimplify it. I'll say reusability. I think the image of re-landing a rocket on a barge, I think for the non-space investors, people with real money and real skepticism, when they see something like that, understanding how hard that is, I think it makes them much more comfortable to come into space and to invest. So, you know, we could argue whether it's true reusability and can you really reuse the fuselage and all that kind of stuff, and space people can geek out about all of that. But I think an image like that is something that's very, very dramatic for the general populace and for investors. And that's why I think when we're flying next year, when Blue's flying next year and we're going over the Kármán line once a week with new astronauts, David, that's going to matter. That's going to really matter. I believe that. And that's when I think we go to a whole other level of space interest and investment.
Adrian got an 11th hour question in again. Certain limitation of CubeSat technology restricts such applications, as the earliest mentioned SAR or other multispectral applications. Robotic assembly of multiple CubeSats in orbit to expand the platform into more capable systems could solve these problems. Are there any commercial plans to accomplish such a system?
Yes. Yes, the short answer is yes. I'm seeing a lot of plans that do in-space assembly to get around that, do more machine-to-machine communication to get around elements of that. We're seeing you know, things like the York system, which is essentially a busable standardized system to get around elements of that. So the short answer is yes. And I think that is an opportunity. Right now, none of these companies, even Planet, which is probably the biggest microsat company, really have scale. And by that I mean scale of manufacturing, you know, scale of purchasing. And so I would suspect we're going to see a lot more consolidation, David, not only for the data drivers that we talked about, but to get more scale in manufacturing technologies and standardization as well.
Okay, Dylan, anything else you'd like to leave us with today?
No, I don't think so, other than, you know, like I said earlier, space has become almost mainstream. The number of calls I get from non-space people is really astonishing. So I think our risk is that it becomes overheated a bit, but it's never been more topical, and certainly investor interest has never been higher. So hopefully it's an optimistic view, and hopefully we're all trending in the right direction here.
So should my listeners start opening up their wallets?
Well, I wouldn't know anything about your listeners' circumstances, financially or otherwise. It is a risky proposition, for sure. But certainly if they have an interest, feel free to have them reach out, and I'll point them in the right direction.
Until the next time, Dylan, thank you very much for joining us. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you, David. Always a pleasure.
Okay, and listeners, pay attention to the schedule for tomorrow and Friday and the coming week. Everybody have a great rest of the weekend. Keep looking up. Goodbye from Dylan, David, and the Space Show.